Today is January 24th, 2019.
How did I ever live this long? Okay.
My name is Deborah Schwartz. I'm with the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society. And I'm sitting here with the wonderful, amazing, musical, and interesting David Freiberg, right? That's how I did I say it right?
Freiberg is yes, E-I, Free Mountain.
Is that what it means?
In German, yeah.
And yes, how did you live to be the, how did you live this long? Because, you know, doing a little pre-research about you, you could have skipped and tripped and fallen any number of ways along the path that brought you to
sure
today.
Yeah. A whole pile of my compadres certainly did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Truly. So congratulations on, you know, you look great.
Thanks.
You really do. I've interviewed a lot of musicians, and I'm always sort of surprised at how really great many of them look, despite what
you think they've been through.
Just being on the road, like, and you're still performing.
Yeah.
I mean, that'll take a bit out of you.
I did take 20 years off, though, so between 1985 and 2005, which is not on the road hardly at all.
Yeah. So. Well, for those that
are listening. But I think I'm healthy. Actually, I feel like I keep myself healthier if I'm on the road for some reason.
Interesting. Well, so I've introduced you as a musician, but there's more to your introduction because you are one of our local musicians who has been a part of the Bay Area music scene, a foundational part of the Bay Area rock music scene. You've had, like Marty Balin once said, he had the best seat in the house for the 60s. I think you were sitting in the same row with him. And
yeah, he was kind of almost next to me, maybe a couple of seats away.
So that's something we can talk about today. The bands that you've been in, Quicksilver, Messenger Service, you know, I'm a woman of a certain age. I certainly remember your band from back in the day.
Okay.
And then, of course.
I would never know that from looking at you, but okay.
Yeah. And looking at me, by the way, I want to apologize. What people that are listening to this can't see is that I recently had some oral surgery, and the whole right side of my face looks like I've been in Fight Club, so I hope that's not too distracting for you.
Having people looking at me disapprovingly if I walk down the street with you, right?
And you seem such a gentleman. Anyway, so sorry about that. But yeah. You really have quite an interesting story, truly. And I remember the Quicksilver Messenger Service so well. And, of course, the other bands that you've been in, which are?
Which are, well, Jefferson Airplane, the Last Tailspin, and then as it changed into Jefferson Starship. Mm-hmm. So that's basically been it. Now I didn't play in when they dropped the Jefferson is when I left for 20 years and then rejoined after Paul Kantner had restarted Jefferson Starship in 1990 and asked me to sit in once in 2005, and it was fun. So
you stayed.
I never left again.
And you're still touring.
And I'm still there, yeah.
Okay, well, let's start with a little contextual information about you yourself, your family. Can you tell me just a little bit about your family history, and can you please include names wherever possible?
Okay.
And when you were born, you know, just
background. I was born on August 24th, 1938, in Boston, Massachusetts, to Rosalind Goldman Freiberg and Albert Freiberg, her husband, who was, let's see, I guess during the Depression, his father was an orthopedic surgeon, a very good or prominent orthopedic surgeon, and had plenty of money. So he kept him in Harvard University, I think, during the Depression. So he has four Harvard degrees and ended up being a lawyer, which not sure that he really wanted to be, but I thought he hated doing it, but which is unfortunate for some people around him. But anyway, and then World War II happened in 1942, 41, 42, and he joined the Navy and my mother and my brother and I moved back, and sister and I moved back to Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where they were, where they grew up. And I spent quite a few years there until I left in 1959 and came to the place that I idolized, which was San Francisco.
You idolized San Francisco?
Yeah, it was on us. On a family trip, we through the West with, you know, four kids and two adults in the car. Kind of like hell on wheels.
I used to go on those family trips. One part sightseeing.
It was really good. No, we went to all the national parks and everything, then drove into San Francisco. And as we came around 101, and all of a sudden the fog was just starting to come in because it was summer, right? Mm-hmm. And it was just so gorgeous. I said, I'm going to live in this place. And I never forgot that.
And you were how old?
Oh, I might have been in high school, actually.
So right then and there.
I might have been 15.
Right then and there, you knew.
I did. And I thought about it and managed to screw my life up enough so that I had to run away. Had to just get out of Cincinnati.
That begs for explanation. How can you screw your life up? Because you go to a Catholic school.
Oh, I didn't really screw it up. But I was did poorly in college and went back and and did a summer school and got a, you know, like a 3.5 average and saw what I was taking. I'm going to major in English Lit, huh? and said, why bother?
Well, back then, I would imagine that kind of major for your family would have been like, yes, you'll be interesting, but you won't be able to support yourself.
So I married a Catholic girl and left, which didn't last that long, but did move me to San Francisco.
So when you came to San Francisco,
I'd never touched a guitar.
Yes. Okay.
You should get into the musical part of it, I guess.
We will. Okay. We will get there because it's really nice to know what propels a person. Some people are musicians from childhood and they want to go where the music is. Other people come upon their future in interesting and nefarious ways. But you were not a musician as a child?
I was.
You were?
Yeah.
What did you play?
Started taking violin lessons at 4.
Oh.
And I think that's because my parents took me to see a Boston Pops concert, children's concert. And I seemed to love it. And they just happened to be friends with the first violist and was one of their best friends who always came over to visit. Mm-hmm. When he came over, he took out his viola, put it down, and I grabbed the bow. And they said, he wants to play violin. In truth, I thought it was the baton. I was a pretty mediocre violin player till I got into junior high and joined the school orchestra. And they switched me to viola. And I loved that.
Yeah, the viola is a lovely sound.
I loved the tone, and it went crazy. And all of a sudden, I was first violist, and then I was in the state orchestra and playing in the string quartet. And
the thing about string instruments is if you can play one, you can pretty much play them all. That's what I learned. I was a cellist, and I could pick up the violin. Now, maybe you couldn't play it as well.
Well, the same ratio, anyway.
Yes, right. Same ratio.
But it's not the guitar, so it's
no,
different.
It's not. But there are strings.
There's strings, yeah.
But so let's get to you. We talked about you first coming to San Francisco and having that knowing, like, this is where I want to be. And then you came with your new wife. Is that what you're... And where did you land?
The last job I had in Ohio was worked for a trucking company as a tracer of lost packages. Anyway, so I theoretically had a job with an affiliate in Berkeley. And we got out here, I think we left on Christmas Eve of 1959 on this, and I had grabbed a bunch of money that I had inherited a little bit, and we took the San Francisco chief out of Chicago on Christmas Eve and ended up in San Francisco, like, on, you know, somewhere between Christmas and New Year's, and ended up living in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And the trucking job didn't work out, and the first job I could find to work on was at a pawn shop in downtown Oakland.
Wow, there's some flavor for you.
Yeah, yeah. And
so Oakland in the 50s was in the late 50s.
Yeah, it was 59.
59, yeah. Was...
Well, it was 60 by the time I got the job, so...
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you? What was the? How was it different from Cleveland?
Cincinnati, excuse me. Well, it was in California, so winter wasn't winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Other than that, it wasn't that bad in 60. I didn't find anything, you know.
But never felt
in danger in Oakland or anything.
How about good?
Hmm?
What was good about it, besides the weather?
Not much. I still would rather have been in San Francisco.
Oh, interesting.
And I didn't particularly like working at the pawn shop. And so I thought I'd stay in transportation. I always loved the railroad, so I ended up getting a job in the freight, in the, what do you call it, freight rate play job at Southern Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to San Francisco. And
so then when you were in San Francisco, and now it's into the 60s.
Yeah, I still haven't ever touched a guitar.
Still haven't touched a guitar.
Oh, and I hadn't been playing violin or anything for a long time. In college, all I did actually was act and sing in choruses,
mm-hmm.
but never took a chorus in it.
So what? I see this guitar in your future, and how did you make your way to it?
Well, my wife left me. Just disappeared one day. I had no idea where she was. Didn't hear from her for a while. I eventually found her, you know. But, and the only thing I could think of to do was to buy a guitar. Because I really loved folk music. And mm-hmm. I never played a guitar, which seemed kind of stupid. So I went out and bought a guitar and started teaching about the Sing Out magazines. And I loved Pete Seeger and the Weavers and went and saw Pete Seeger at Longshoreman's Hall in San Francisco and was completely, he was my hero after that. Just mm-hmm. the way he could sing a song, get everybody to sing with him. And I still my hero, actually. But...
So I got
a guitar and started learning how to play and started hanging out in coffee houses and singing at Hootenanny Night, you know, on the open mic, Hootenanny Nights. And because I saw the people who were doing it, I said, well,
I can't be worse than that. Did you think that?
Huh?
Did you think I can't be worse than that person? Or did you? I mean, I've heard you sing.
Absolutely.
And you have the most beautiful voice.
Well, it took some time. But yeah. And... one day I noticed a little card up on the bulletin board at one of the coffee houses, and it said, "Wanted folk singers for peace." We're going to travel without money down through Mexico, all the way down through South America, living with the people for peace and brotherhood. To spread peace and brotherhood. And that sounded like, what a nice thing to do.
This is what year?
Probably 62.
Because Vietnam at was, this...
Yeah, I hadn't been drafted or anything.
Uh-huh.
And I wouldn't have been.
You wouldn't have been?
I don't think so.
Too old? Too young? Too heart condition?
Well, my wife had a... ended up coming back to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pregnant.
Oh. I see.
And so all of a sudden I was a father. although it wasn't, I really wasn't, but anyway.
Gotcha.
So I wouldn't have been drafted at that point, probably just before that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so.
So, but your father, yet you're going to go on the road for peace?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I talked Southern Pacific into giving me a leave of absence for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And there was only three people that ended up going. The guy that was starting the thing and a little Jewish girl named Sandy, who just graduated from college. And
the guy who started the thing?
And the guy that started it was an ex-Marine.
His name?
Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you, Sandy, and Michael.
Yep. Played a bunch of music, played a little, sat around and played songs together. And Sandy and I were both Jewish, so we knew a bunch of Hebrew folk songs and you know, and so we went along and we took the third class train. This is a long story, but third class train out of Mexicali to Mexico City. And by the time we got, you know, we bought tacos off people that were selling them at the train stations and paid not much attention to, never did get sick.
So you were just free
and we
and
ended
easy.
Up coming into Mexico City. I got 12 pesos between all of us. Went to the American Friends Service Committee and found a place to sleep and started going out to parks and opening up the guitar case and starting to sing, and people would throw pesos in it.
So you were street musicians.
Street musicians at that point, yeah. And people would ask us to sing, and we went out and found some, and talked to some people that were interested in the same sort of things politically at the University of Mexico, and met an artist who said, "Why don't you come stay at my place?" And he was from Colombia, and he was a student of Siqueiros, the muralist, and who was in prison at that point for, I guess, for being too far left.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. And we were having a good time. And so one night we were out on this, we played for our dinner at the kosher restaurant in Mexico City.
The name of the restaurant?
I don't remember.
Yep. Okay.
But there are a lot of Jews in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. Most of them own jewelry stores, it seemed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were set up in a park, and somebody asked us if we'd sing at their meeting. And we said, "Oh, sure." So we went and sang at the meeting and had no idea what it was. None of us really spoke Spanish other than, you know, tortilla.
So,
you know.
I'm going to guess what kind of meeting this is.
It must have been communist, yeah.
Yes, must have been.
And there was somebody up there talking about Yankee imperialismo and things like that, you know. And it was.
So now you're.
And so we got up and sang. I don't know. I have a hammer, probably. And compared.
If
pieces.
I had a hammer.
Right.
Sing it in the morning.
Sing it in the evening. All over this land. Anyway.
Yeah, right.
And compared Pete Seeger. Compared Pete Seeger to Siqueiros. Was
so now in that time of
the next morning.
Yes, right,
knock,
that
knock,
fast.
Knock on the door.
Oh, there must have been agents in the audience.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
it was
so
an open
that was
meeting.
It. What a buzzkill on your free and easy.
And all of a sudden, we're all and they arrested the poor artist too, who had nothing to do with it. He wasn't even there.
You know, judged by the company you keep, I guess.
Poor guy. He was a sweetheart.
And so what happened?
He was really good, too. I think. So anyway, I don't know what happened to him. I never found out. He probably got deported back to Colombia.
And how about you? Registered as communists and
well, no. But they questioned us and realized that we really didn't do anything other than be left wing.
Be young and dumb.
And so they threw us in jail overnight and woke us up early in the morning, put us in a car and drove us directly up to an American Airlines flight, put us on it. And all of a sudden we found ourselves after, you know, eating, begging food and everything. We were first class to San Antonio, but they left us in San Antonio.
But there's nice music in San Antonio, yes?
Yeah.
So what
happened? Turns out Sandy's college roommate's father was Lyndon B. Johnson's personal attorney in Austin. And we were really annoyed we got getting deported because that ruined the whole thing. All of a sudden, here we are back again, and we never got out of Mexico. And so she was going to talk to her, try to talk to her roommate's father, and I don't know what he could do about it. But anyway, we hitchhiked up to Austin and did that. And while she was doing that, Mike and I went to the student union where they were having a folk music society meeting and, you know, sat around picking and singing with everybody and noticed there was this real nice guy with a beard who talked to us and named Chet. And there was this girl playing auto harp with this really huge voice. And she was singing an Irish murder ballad, but at that point, but she didn't have the voice of a Irish. She sounded really bluesy. But it was an interesting, mm-hmm. It was really interesting. We traded addresses. That was Janis.
That was Janice Joplin?
And the Chet was Chet Helms, who ran the Avalon Ballroom. And so we traded addresses.
They were living here at that time?
No, they were living in she was in Austin.
Oh, so she hadn't come to the Bay Area yet?
No, not yet.
Did she come to the Bay Area because of you?
They came and slept on our floor for a couple of weeks, or a week, or less, I don't know. And Chet had told the story that if Freiberg hadn't been deported from Mexico...
I never heard this before.
Anyway.
Wow. I mean, so what was Janice like at that age? How old was she?
I don't know. 18.
And she had 19. That bluesy voice.
Yeah, yeah. And then she came up and she was playing around. I know she sang some stuff with Jorma Kalkinen, who mm-hmm. and
from
who was would be in Jefferson Airplane.
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh.
But he was a student at Santa Clara University at that point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I ended up singing with this girl named Michaela. It was as David and Michaela.
That was your group then?
That was my group, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're continuing with your folk music.
Yeah, and I ended up leaving the Southern Pacific. Mm-hmm.
So at that time, were you thinking to yourself that this is what I want to be, or did you, I mean, to be a musician?
It seemed like Michaela and I were able to make more money on a few weekends a month than I was actually making it. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it was iffy.
Did you have confidence in your ability as a musician, or you just you just jumped?
Learning as I went along. You know, just playing, picking and singing with everybody that was around. This is real folk music. You know, you're learning from everybody. From Jerry Garcia was around, and you know, we knew all these people from that were playing at the clubs.
So those early
Paul
clubs,
Kantner,
yes. So I interviewed Marty Ballin, your friend.
And he was playing with the Town Criers at that point.
So was it kind of like you musicians in your earlier stage were sort of in the learning phase more, or maybe there's a phase?
No, we were always we were all learning.
Yeah, you were all learning.
I think we all were. I mean, Jorma actually took lessons from. Having a senior moment.
That's okay. If it comes to you, we'll add it. Had you any concept in your mind at all at that time that the people, your community of musical friends, would go on to be such amazingly successful, including yourself, musicians? Was that ever in your head? Did you have that in the horizon of your mind?
I was just enjoying learning. Turns out also the first time I smoked dope was in Mexico City at that. So I have that to thank. Them to thank for all my arrests.
What were there, 3 arrests for pot?
Yeah, none of them for more than, always for less than an ounce of marijuana.
It may be hard for some people to remember, but there is a time in California where the smell of marijuana was this prevalent in all outdoor spaces as the smell of the pines,
yeah,
or the ocean air, that it was the scent of the 60s. And so
you had to be really pretty dumb to get arrested, though.
So are you bragging now about your dumbness? Because how did you get arrested? And I mean, now we're talking at this point in 2019 when marijuana is basically legal. It is. And it's being produced on huge scales. But back then,
yep,
it was so very different.
Yeah. Let me see. I think I made a left turn at Masonic and Fell Street, not realizing it was after 4.
Oh, that was that's what precipitated your
and
possession.
The policeman that stopped me looked under my front seat because he thought he saw me putting something under there, which he did. Mm-hmm. And it was, I don't know, a little baggie of less than an ounce of grass. And boom, I'm arrested.
This is your second time now being pulled, yanked by the neck and thrown into a jail cell. You've got Mexico, and now you've got here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
May I ask, were you a long-haired man at that time? Did you fit a profile that the officer might have?
I wasn't a long hair
in San Francisco in the 60s?
I probably had long hair.
Because remember how cops could be, they could profile you on the length of your hair?
Yeah, I probably had long hair at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Not really long, but I don't really remember. But I think, I'm looking back, I used to have my mugshot. No, I had a mustache, I think, and slightly long hair. I got the color to look kind of more like an Italian fisherman or something.
Mm-hmm.
The mugshot, anyway. But, no. And I had been, I actually was living with Paul Kantner and a bunch of people, a community living in a flat that was on Turk and Fillmore, more or less, right across from the Pink Palace. That's gone now.
Yep, I remember.
You remember the Pink Palace.
Hard to forget.
Yeah. And and so when I got busted, I said, I don't know. That really shocked me. What am I going to do? We really weren't working. I wasn't with I had broken up with Michaela and Kantner. Paul and I had been through a bunch of stuff. We were probably lived together for about a year in various places, in San Jose and Venice, California, and, thinking we were going to become folk singers, but really, getting a group that we could make money with. But
this is before.
There we were watching the Beatles movie and looking, now that's what we should be doing.
You mean which one, A Hard Day's Night or Help?
Hard Day's Night,
yes.
Yeah.
So
and
you mean,
Help, but yeah.
And to, so you, in the sense that you were to become a dedicated group with...
Well, the Hard Day's Night really almost resembled what we were really doing, what we were actually doing.
You'd be
I'm sure
all
the
that...
Beatles weren't doing that, but they kind of did when they were in Hamburg,
uh-huh,
as we find out.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so that was...
And this is before Kantner met Marty Balin?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, this is before there was... And it turns out that, okay, so that's, then I moved to Marin County.
In what year is
got,
that?
64, 65.
Wow, you preceded some of the others moving here. Because a lot of them came in the late 60s. The Grateful Dead.
I got a job. I went and got a job as... in a freight forwarding company because I had experience doing that kind of stuff. And apparently the guy that my supervisor, Southern Pacific, gave me a glowing, said he'd hire me back in a second.
So you came to
that really surprised me because all I ever did was yell at me.
So you moved to Marin County. Where specifically in the county did you move?
Let's see. Well, I lived at an illegal rental somewhere that was, somebody's basement, mm-hmm, kind of out on the, if you turned it left turn back behind where Whole Foods is.
Oh, over in the Homestead Valley here in Mill Valley.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up renting a little house that overlooked the San Rafael Bridge in San Quentin Village. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is go to work and come home, smoke dope as much as I could, get up my 12-string and sing Beatles songs to the, learned all the Beatles songs and sang them to the San Rafael Bridge until I fall asleep. And then I go do the same thing the next day. And one day there was a knock on the door, and it was an acquaintance wanting a little dope. And so I said, but to me it was audience. Listen to all these Beatles songs. I need some dope. Could I get, do you have any? I said, just got seeds and stems. I didn't have very much. And I said, I'll split what I got with you. And so, and he tried to give me $10 for it. And I said, no, man.
I think that's what a lid cost back then, $10.
Yeah, but this wasn't a lid. This was just a little bit.
How generous.
Stuff that was mostly stems and seeds, really, mm-hmm. you know. I said, no, just take it. And he says, no, here, take this $5. And I said, okay.
Oh, no. I got it. Yes, I see.
He was wired, too.
Yes.
And the state narcotics, he had been busted for selling to people. And he was representing that I was his connection, which was the first time he ever tried to get anything from me.
He set you up.
Yeah, he set me up.
That's your second arrest.
And that was my second. So off I go to San Rafael.
No, wait, that's your third.
Second.
Oh, no, that's for pot, second. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, I wasn't really arrested. I was just...
The first one was a detainment, I suppose.
I got detained and deported. Not arrested, deported.
Wow.
Yes. Cinco acquitores expulsados. It's a big headline in La Prensa. And I saw it years later.
So, but for the second pot arrest, that was a setup. And
I ended up being, and so there I was. And so I lost that job, obviously, and didn't know anybody that would co-sign for the bail. And I was in there for like 30 days or so.
In the Marin County lockup in San Rafael?
Yeah, until they finally realized, hey, this guy isn't going to get bail.
We better
let him go on his own recognizance. And
what was the San Rafael Richmond Bridge's favorite Beatles song? Or did you have one?
Well, that would be interesting.
I mean, there's certain sounds that I think would accompany the hum of the bridge.
I don't remember.
What's one of your favorite Beatles songs? Or do you have one?
Oh, they're all, I love them all. I really love the Beatles. Here I stand.
Hey, you've got to hide your love away.
That was one of the ones I really liked.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is a beautiful
song. That was the Bridges' favorite, I think.
That was the Bridges' favorite song? Interesting. I hadn't realized the bridge was so romantic.
Yeah. Doesn't look it, does it?
Actually, it's a lovely bridge. How it hovers so close to the water.
So while I was in jail, Kantner did come over and visit me. Mm-hmm. This is the old jail, right? This mm-hmm. is the one that was across from where Macy's used to be in central San Rafael.
On 4th Street.
The old courthouse. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It must have been built around the Civil War or something like that. And so Kantner came to see me in there, and he noticed there was this little whole crack in the window, and he stuck a joint through it. And told me that he was starting a band with Marty Ballin, and they think they were going to call it Jefferson Airplane. And I said, wow, that sounds great. Yeah. And so when I got released, I was already been talking to John Cipollina and Jimmy Murray about, I was supposed to be forming a band with Dino Valenti, who apparently wanted a band, but he couldn't stay out of jail.
So, pot busts for him, too?
That's what I always heard, mm-hmm. I assume. But they really treated him badly. He was off in the state prison system.
Oh, dear.
So I don't understand why, but...
Mm. So you were saying
and that. And so we were out on, I was out in the streets and sleeping on friends' floors and stuff, you know, didn't have anything but have a guitar. Mm-hmm. And so we were trying to form a band. And then all of us, while I was doing that, my trial comes up for the first bust. And they put me in San Bruno for a 60-day sentence. And gave me 10 days to turn myself in 10 days to clear up my affairs. And I think I took acid on the night before I went in.
You are incorrigible.
That was funny.
Yes.
I walk into the Hall of Justice in San Francisco and try to get into the jail elevator, and the doors go almost shut and then open up. And I push the button again, and they went almost shut and opened up. And I'm still coming down from this acid trip. Uh-huh. Then. So I say, well, if it does that again, I'm just going to take that as a sign and just not go. So they close.
Oh, almost.
Yeah, almost. Well, I would have really been in trouble if I didn't turn
myself in. Yes. Were you nervous about going to jail?
Huh?
Were you nervous about going to jail?
Well, I'd already been in San Rafael jail for 30 days, and I didn't like it, but it was weirder in San Bruno because they wanted me to cut my hair or else stay in the gay section.
Whoa.
And I probably should have stayed in the gay section, actually. It would have been much more entertaining. But it didn't sound right because there was...
Yeah. So when you get out of San Bruno,
I didn't know what I know now.
Yes. And, you know, there's a lot of social programming back in that time. And,
yeah.
Yeah, and you're...
But if I know what I know now, in a minute I would have stayed there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so stupid. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and then hearing my friend Crosby on singing Turn, Turn, Turn on the radio.
With the birds?
Yeah, with the birds. And singing.
So you're friends with David Crosby?
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, he was oftentimes resident of Paul and our house with Paul in Venice while we were in L.A. So
when were you in L.A.?
Probably 64, late 64.
He'd grown up in Santa Barbara, as I recall. Mm-hmm.
I met him when he was in Pasadena, when he was playing with a group called Les Baxter's Balladeers. It was Les Baxter's folk group. Anyway.
Well, I have to say, when I was doing a little research about you before this interview, that I hadn't known that you performed in David Crosby's solo album, If Only I Could Remember My Name. Is that
true?
Yeah,
I sang some on it, yeah.
Which has got to be one of the loveliest albums ever made. It's truly beautiful.
There's some beautiful stuff on there.
Really beautiful, yeah. And it's haunting references to Mill Valley and this area.
Oh, Tamalpais, yeah.
Yeah, Tamalpais.
And Tam High.
Damtown High at, what is it, 2 p.m. yeah, or something. Yeah. Just beautiful. I probably listened to that album 2,000 times.
Around that time, I mean, Quicksilver was recording. We'd all been at Wally Hyder's studio down in San Francisco, and Airplane were there, and the Dead were there. And while David was making that record, we were also trying to make the Planet Earth Rock and Roll Orchestra. And so that was, you know, David and Graham and Paul and Grace and Jorma and Jack and Jerry Garcia and Phil Lesh and, I don't know, and me and... And it could be all kinds of people, you know. So there was a few sessions there where we spent all day, you know, whole night, just everybody around playing guitars, and it all got recorded. And so there's this underground tape and digital file of all those things, of a bunch of songs that everybody was writing, you know, that just... never finished at all. You know, but
the way you describe this, it's like you're in the incubation room for some of the best music, arguably, of the century. I mean, the music in the 70s the rock and roll, the Dead, Crosby, Stills, Nash.
That was about 69.
69. Yeah. But even on, the music was so amazingly beautiful and wonderful. And you're there in the center of it. How did that feel?
Kind of like Forrest Gump, huh?
Did you feel like that?
No, I was just there, you know.
Did you ever have experiences where you as, you know, you're performing, you're an amazing performer, but you just thought to yourself, you know, here I am listening to this person sing this way and that song, and that you were...
I was entitled,
you didn't have to pay for the ticket.
I was entitled to hear some of the coolest music of all time, you know, just for being in San Francisco and being one of the bands that where I could just walk into the Avalon or the Fillmore or Winterland without, you know, I'd just say hi and I'd walk in, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I'd see whoever was Cream or Miles Davis or...
You had carte blanche because of
because we were in the bands.
So you were Quicksilver Messenger Service. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that band.
Oh, so after I got out of San Bruno, because we hadn't quite got the band together when I got sent away. We had met the other two, John and Jim met the other two guys, Gary Duncan and Greg Elmore, at one of the, I'm not trying to remember which one it was, one of the family dog, early family dog things, or so anyway, they had already started playing with him. And they said, they were just waiting for me to come out because they thought I'd be the bass player because I was a 12-string player, whatever that means. It doesn't really translate, but
I
never
reasoned
played bass
it that
before.
Way.
But yeah,
they were just holding a spot for you, I suppose.
Well, I don't know because I, yeah. Well, I was part of it until I was rudely interrupted. and so they brought me out of there. Actually, they came to pick me up at the Hall of Justice.
Really? They came for you when they released you?
Yeah, John and Jimmy, but I was waiting for I had to see my probation officer first, and he was gone at that point, so I had to wait till he got back to the office. And so I actually rode out with John and Jimmy and got stoned and then went back. I talked to my probation officer. He says, I know there's nothing wrong with marijuana, but it's illegal. And I told them that they should let you see what's going to happen if you don't stop.
And this he's telling you after you're high?
That, yeah. And I'm saying, oh, right. Well, I'll definitely never do that again.
You are so typical of that time, I tell you.
Well, what else could I do?
What else could you do?
I mean, I say, no, I'm going to keep on smoking. No, you know. I say, yes, sir. And so then we left and I never talked to him again.
And then you start, or in your band.
Hmm?
And then, so then you entered into the Quicksilver Messenger Service phase after that?
Yeah, and then we're trying to figure out what to call it.
Mm-hmm. How did you get that name?
It's astrological, actually. Gary and Greg were both born on the same day, September 4th, I believe, and they're Virgos. John Chipolin and I were born on August 24th. Virgos. So all those four people, all Virgos. Jimmy Murray wasn't a Virgo. He was a Gemini. But the thing they all have in common was the ruling planet of Virgo and Gemini is Mercury. And Mercury is Quicksilver. And it's the messenger god. So it was Quicksilver Messenger Service. I don't know.
Wow. I had no idea. That's great. I mean, Jefferson Airplane's the name of someone's dog.
No.
That's what Marty said.
Well, it could have been.
In his interview.
But it was kind of like, I thought it was, the way I heard it was from Yorma, was that it was, some friend was making up names for old black folk singers. Blues singers, and there's Blind Lemon Jefferson. So this was just called Blind Jefferson Starship. I'm Blind Jefferson Airplane. Actually, Blind Jefferson Airplane or something.
Yeah, that's,
I think that's where it came from.
Yeah,
but
that,
I don't
maybe
know.
That story. I mean, but that whoever could named the dog name, named, named
the,
after
they, yeah, could have named it
dog. But that's yeah, that's what Marty said in his interview. But Quicksilver
is
messenger
as good as
service,
anything.
I really, it's yeah, it's very clever.
Yeah.
And John Cipollino.
Yeah. He's a Mill Valley native.
Yes, yes.
Well, he was really born in Berkeley, but
he grew up
yeah,
here.
Yeah,
and he has this legendary status as the ultimate rock god kind of character. Died too soon.
Oh yeah.
Tell me about John.
John. Well, he was one of the cool things about Quicksilver was, there was Jimmy Murray and me who were folk singers.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy left as soon as we started. While we were just sitting around and playing a little bit and everything like that. I don't know why. He's passed away now, too. But as soon as we started practicing and being serious about learning, you know, we're putting stuff together, he left and moved to Maui. And I really didn't know why. But this meant Gary had to take care of more of the guitar playing, and he was really a good guitar player and should have been doing that. And so it was probably a plus that we were four people instead of five people, actually. Mm-hmm. And so John and Gary and Greg all were rockers, never played folk music at all. And almost all the other bands around here, and nobody ever really played rock and roll before.
Mm-hmm.
They were all, you know, were blue, you know, finger pickers, you know, and you know, Jerry Garcia's banjo, you know, all those guys were folk singers too, Grateful Dead. And so that was the difference between Quicksilver and the other ones, was we really had a drummer and two guitarists that never played folk music. And so I brought in a bunch of folk songs, but when we played them, they weren't folk songs anymore.
They were folk songs on steroids.
Right, right. So anyway, John, he was such a unique player. It's hard to say what he really. But he's just a really sweet guy, really wonderful person, and would talk to anybody. Didn't really think that much about himself, you know, and really liked the old time rock and roll players, like, you know, Link Wray and the original rock and roll things, rather, you know, he wasn't more contemporary, like, anyway, so, but he played his guitar, he put guitars together. He always used the very, really skinny strings, and had to be a Bigsby tailpiece with the Wang bar on it, which he used on every note, pretty much. And which would take his guitar out of tune as soon as you use it. His guitar was always out of tune, but he'd play it. So with using the bar, so you couldn't tell. He just made him sound unique. You know, it didn't sound out of tune because it was pulled into tune. You know, so but it was a very thing, and used a couple of finger picks, a thumb pick and a finger pick, and some of the times it would be just rubbing the strings, going, ah, so it would just make strange noises with the wah-wah pedal, and he designed pick guards for his guitar so they looked like bat wings, and he was just very unique, and he had the stance, and girls just fell over for him, just from. He'd be standing there, and he was the prototype, I think, for
the rock god,
for the rock guitar player.
Yeah,
the hair hanging down over one eye, and
yeah,
and he was great.
So how long did you stay with Quicksilver Messenger Service?
Well, in 1969, Gary Duncan left. And he went off with Dino Valenti, who we were supposed to, you know.
Who had their hard time in with the jails.
Yeah. And going to be become rich and famous in New York or something. And they went off and left us there. So, and I couldn't talk him out of it. But he had a drug problem. He was getting into speed.
That's a hard ride.
And I think Dino at least got him to quit. So, and after a year, they both came back. And almost exactly a year. And so when we had picked up Nicky Hopkins, the great English keyboard player who played with the Rolling Stones and in pretty much every band in San Francisco for 1 year. And then he joined us because he liked it here. And he and John were like, actually, it was very funny. He was born on February 24th, which is exactly 6 months. So he's the exact opposite of John Cipollina. Mm-hmm. But he was just like John. They both collected little things. You know, John would never have, would save every matchbook he ever had. He would, and set lists on little cards, you know, the set lists, he would save every one of them. And he had piles of stuff, you know. And Nicky was the same, and they hit it off. That's probably why he joined Quicksilver, because they hit it off so well.
If there's a kind of rule book that you would go by as a young musician starting a band back then, what would be some...
There was no rule book.
No rule book. There was no standard protocol. You didn't have a checklist. You didn't keep things in mind. You just... What?
No. Most important thing... excuse me. Most important thing would be to make sure you had enough marijuana.
I didn't expect that. Okay, good to all note that.
What was the saying? There was it's more important to have marijuana than money. I don't know.
But there were a lot of other drugs back then.
Yeah, there was LSD. And
did it ever get to be a problem with your music?
Not mine.
For you?
No, I didn't really like cocaine. Mm-hmm. A bunch of people really liked it. I tried it, but it just, for me, it just made me, I don't know, if once you took a hit of it, and it said, wow, that's pretty cool. And then you kept looking for that first, pretty, hey, that's pretty cool, but it never happened again. And so you kept trying to get more, and it made you want more, and you had to have more, and it just didn't work.
Just chasing your tail.
Yeah.
I remember when I first met David Crosby.
Ooh, he really got into it.
Yes, he really got into it.
Freebasing.
Yes.
Yeah, actually, I went with Paul and Grace and me. And
oh, you were part of the intervention?
Part of the intervention, yeah, in Mill Valley. Yeah. And he went off, but he didn't last very long. Mm-hmm. And he always blessed the judge that put him in jail. Because that's who it really saved his life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where he couldn't get any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all...
And now he's playing some of the best music he's ever written. It's really good.
That's something in my interviews with various peoples and considering the time, you know, when cocaine was considered healthier than alcohol, let's say, or whatever the spin was back then. But there was a time in Marin County's history when there was a lot of drugs, and then in came the coke, and then there was a lot of coke, and a lot of people got burned.
Oh, yeah.
Was that sort of endemic in your profession? Because, yes, you're shaking your head up and down, yes.
Mm.
The pitfalls that you could come across as a musician, is that?
When I joined with the airplane, Paul had stopped Coke? None. He didn't do any. I don't think Grace did either. Grace was alcohol. Grace's thing was alcohol. And I don't remember much coke around Jefferson Airplane at that point. I mean, Yorma and Jackers are absolutely straight now. Mm-hmm. And
so when did you join Jefferson Airplane?
See, I left. 72, I think.
So they are super hot at that point.
Beautiful. Well, Marty had left. That was why I joined.
Oh, so were you the Marty replacement?
Theoretically the Marty replacement, yeah. I didn't think of it as that because I sang harmony on the same songs that he would have sung harmony on, mm-hmm. but we didn't try to have me sing Today or Plastic Fantastic Lover, any those tunes. We just didn't do them.
You just didn't do his mm-hmm. beautiful ballads. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel the responsibility to live up to Marty Balin's history and his singing and his position?
Well, now if Marty's songs are going to get sung by somebody, it's going to have to be somebody here. I mean, Kathy sings a bunch of Marty songs mm-hmm. in the band, in Jefferson Starship now, and I sing some.
I know. We recorded, Gary Yost and I came to your house and coming back to me, and it was, I think we took three takes, and I, so yeah. beautiful. Two takes? Three takes?
I don't remember.
It was so beautiful. I mean, so very beautiful. You do such a lovely, lovely job
thanks.
Of it. It was a sad time then because
he had just passed away. Yeah.
So you did join the Jefferson Airplane in 72.
Yeah, which was, and so after Jefferson Airplane, we did one tour, which was really successful as far as we could tell. And then there's an album called 30 Seconds Over Winterland, which is live recordings from that tour. And that's my only Jefferson Airplane album, I guess. Mm-hmm. And after that, I was in the band, but somehow there was never another tour. And Paul and Grace and I, were, I think Paul and Grace each owed RCA a solo album. So we were hanging out together anyway. So Paul Grace and I made one called Baron von Tollbooth and the Chrome Nun, which is ostensibly Paul's solo debt to RCA. And it came out just saying that it was Paul Kantner, Grace Slick, and David Freiberg at the time. And then, so that was, we put that out. And then Grace had one called Manhole. So it was basically the same people made Manhole too. And after that was done, we said, and we were looking around, it doesn't look like Jefferson Airplane's going to play anymore. So, and besides, RCA cut off our salaries. So I guess we better, what are we going to call it? And Paul's first solo album was called Blows Against the Empire. And on it, he listed everybody that played, that was on it, as the Jefferson Starship crew. And so it seemed to me that, I don't know that I brought it up or not. I have the feeling I brought it up, and I'm sure Paul and Grace thought they brought it up. But whatever, it was obvious that, well, we call it Jefferson Starship, right? And so we called it Jefferson Starship and put together a band, which, except for Pete Sears, was the band, because Pete was busy recording for Rod Stewart at that point in England, so he couldn't make it over for that tour. But when he got back, he joined, and it was Jefferson Starship. And we started making Jefferson Starship records.
One of your songs from those records jumped out from a Netflix show that I was watching. It opens with, I believe, tell me if it's wrong that you wrote this song, but have you heard of this show that opens with the song Jane?
With Jane? Oh, yeah. Wet Wild American Summer or something?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wet hot American
Wet, hot
summer,
American summer, yeah.
Which is the funniest show.
Oh, do you think it was funny?
Yes, I do. Because it's about young kids in camp.
Right.
But all mostly the actors
about,
are older.
About, right.
So these
playing
all
young,
are adults,
playing young,
playing
kids.
Young people. But your song, Jane, did you write Jane?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that song has a presence, and it really, really creates quite an interesting opening for that show. In fact, it makes it, in my opinion. That show's opening would be nothing without your song.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
Yes. And it is an... So tell me a little bit about your songwriting. And
I don't know. I always wrote a bunch of songs. I very rarely wrote the lyrics, except for... But every now and then I would. And when I look back on them, I don't really particularly. But I wrote Jane with my friend Jim McPherson, who was who's passed away. But he was a really good songwriter. And I don't know, I met him at probably, well, he played in John Cipollina's band, Copperhead, after John left Quicksilver. Mm-hmm. And he played, and Pete Sears, who ended up being Jefferson's, I saw Pete Sears and I said, wow, these two guys are both really good keyboard players and bass players, and they just, whatever the other isn't, apparently they just switch back and forth. And I said, it was really cool because right then I started playing the piano because I was writing songs, because it was easier to write songs for me on the piano than on guitar for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how to play the piano, but I knew, you know, I could read music and I knew where the notes were. And so I just figured out how, and I knew harmony and, you know, so I just figured out how to get two parts out with, you know, and so it seemed like easier after messing around to write tunes with it. So I wrote a bunch of songs on the piano.
And so did you write the music or the lyrics and the music?
I wrote the music and some of the lyrics. Mm-hmm. But Jimmy put them together but I'd say if it wasn't for him, it would never got finished. But
you don't sing it.
No, I don't know. But then Marty was back in the band. It was kind of this thing. We have how many lead singers can you have? You know, mm-hmm. And I said, okay, I'll be a support. It had no big deal to me. Mm-hmm. You know, because Marty was, this is Marty Ballin, man.
He's now part of, at this point,
he's part
he
of,
comes and he was, joins the band's Jefferson
at that
Starship.
Point, when I wrote it, he was the male lead singer, you know, in mm-hmm. Grace. And I would sing harmony on everything, but
songs.
And I would either play bass or keyboards depending on, you know, what Pete and I figured out who should do it, you know.
Were there any songs in particular during your Starship days with Marty back that you enjoyed?
I actually wrote one with him and Bob Hunter from the Dead called Tumblin' that's on Red Octopus, but didn't really come out that is like I wanted it to. Mm-hmm. But it's a nice song. Anyway, you could look for it.
Are your songs ever like children, you love them all, or do you have favorites?
There's one I wrote with Gary Duncan on Quicksilver called The Fool, which I really liked.
Can you sing a few lines?
I don't know. It's a long thing, and it's mostly instrumental.
Ah.
And it's on the first Quicksilver album, so you ought to check it.
I'll
check
have to go back
out.
To my collection.
It's a whole extravaganza. It's very, very hippie and almost Buddhist, although I wasn't a Buddhist at that point, but the lyrics are...
You mentioned earlier that you took a hiatus for 20 years.
Yeah.
When did that begin?
85. If I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have met Linda, so that was really cool.
Linda's your wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At one point, Gary Duncan from Quicksilver was making an out. He had a studio in San Rafael, and he called me up and said, after I quit, or was fired, quit. Same thing. I was trying to figure out how to get out because this wasn't my kind of thing. And I knew I wasn't really doing anything. And that's the reason I left Quicksilver, too. I wasn't really doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but anyway. And so I went to, Gary called me up and said, hey, would you want to come over and sing some background vocals? I got four songs that need background vocals that the two chicks I had singing on were too stoned and none of it works. And I have this chick singer coming over. And do you want to do that? And I said, sure, something to do. Okay, so I went over to Duncan's studio, and it was Linda. And things just came to me. We became friends, and we each had other love interests at that point when we met. But then we became friends, and by 1990, we got married. So
I've been to your house.
Yeah.
It has the most wonderful feeling in it. It feels
like... A lot of that's
like...
Linda. Yeah,
if as the prophet says, your house is your larger self, then I really like your wife.
Good, yeah.
Because there's such warmth and creativity and natural. I don't know. There's just an ambiance that you just feel at home when you walk in.
Yeah, I know I do. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you do too. Great. Mm-hmm.
And with all the beautiful trees, all the
oaks. Yeah, it was a great place.
And she's quite a singer in her own right.
She's really a good singer, yeah.
Do you perform together ever?
Occasionally. Somehow now, not as much as... We've been, you know, she had her own band, and I went and got into it. But somehow it always turned into Quicksilver.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of annoying. But...
So your family, let's talk a little bit about your family. Because not all rock and rollers or musicians... Who travel a lot and have such opportunities for girls and just all kinds of cool stuff. Not all of them actually have families that work out where there's love and domesticity, but some...
Well, it was like that. I mean, my first wife... Well, the first wife disappeared after I got out here, more or less, because that... The girl I had during Quicksilver, I married Julia, or her name was Girl. Her nickname was Girl because she had five brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So she was always called Girl. And that's a funny story. We got married because she was underage and... She was my friend, but I think the court said something like she either had to go back to, if she wasn't married, she had to go back to high school. And she did not want to go back to TAM High. And I said, okay, I'll marry you if you just want to, you know. And so we got married. And so that's how it started. But we did have a kid together.
Your child?
My first child, yeah. Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a wonderful person. She's a wonderful person, she loved to travel for the joy of traveling, and I didn't. I'd go if I could play, if I had a gig. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. But she would go take a round the world trip by herself, just meeting people. And so that's who she was, and probably still is. Still is. But so we had a kind of like, okay, we're together now, and now we're not, and then we're together, and then we're not. So I went through the thing, and I did have a lot of girlfriends. So
mm-hmm. Yeah. Nothing sexier than a rock and roll musician. Back then.
So it seemed. I couldn't see it myself.
Really? That's interesting.
But it seemed like that, yeah.
I mean, they've made movies about groupies.
And so girl is now Julia, and she's married, been married to the same guy for a long time. He's a... He's Joe Satriani's manager, so and used to work for Bill Graham, and he's Mick Brigden. She's Julia Brigden now, so still friends.
Bill Graham.
Yeah.
Were you close friends with him?
Well, we were friends. Yeah, I'd say friendly with him. I could call him up and he'd take the call.
I saw in an interview where you described that he was thinking about having a place for retired rock and roll musicians.
That's what he always told us.
What did he say?
He says, you guys are just going to go through your money. He says, I know I'm going to have a home for old rock and roll guys. So I'll take care of you guys when you're old. And then he went and got killed.
Yeah, I'm
ruined the whole thing.
He could have just used his own very own compound for you.
Oh yeah.
Could, yes. Okay, so that's three marriages in total for you.
Yeah.
And do you have other children as well, besides Jessica?
Yes, I have one that was Polly, the oldest one, who was never married her mom. So she came to live with me when she was in high school.
When now you're 80 years old?
Yep, I am.
You look fabulous.
Oh, thanks.
But you're touring.
Yeah.
For a man that doesn't really like to travel unless you're touring.
Just got back from New Zealand.
Just back from New Zealand.
Yeah.
And you're touring. Did you ever imagine yourself touring at 80 years old when you were a younger man?
I couldn't imagine me even being 40 years old. But there you were.
Do you not have to worry about your pot when you're like you used to back in the day going through?
I don't really smoke pot anymore.
No more. When did you give that up?
I don't not smoke it, but I just... Around 1983 or 4, I think, it stopped. It seemed like it stopped working for me. It didn't do what it always made me want to play music and really get into music, and it stopped doing that. It seemed to stop me from doing it, actually. So I didn't see much point in spending a lot of money on it.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of stopped. But I still love the smell of it, and I'm certainly not against it. I mean, most of my friends do smoke pot, so every occasionally I'll grab a hit.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't say that I don't smoke pot. I just.
But I mean, you're now. I mean, my friends that are musicians. They travel a lot. They're like the gypsies, traveling gypsies. Traveling can take a lot out of you, and you're going to different time zones.
Well, yeah. We don't have much gun. I think we have one in a week or so. And one off in Ohio.
Do you enjoy performing on stage now?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I love playing with these guys that I'm with.
And who are you with
now? That's in the
band
now. Chris Smith.
Amazing pianist.
Well, he's my son-in-law, so.
Oh, my
he
gosh.
He married Polly, see?
Yes.
So.
Uh-huh.
And, but I played with him for years before and all of a sudden they met and, whoops. And Kathy Richardson, the lead singer, who's just killer, but she lives in Chicago, so we only get to see her when I go on the road, mostly. Mm-hmm. And Donnie Baldwin, who was playing with Jefferson Starship when I left, and went on and played in Starship without the Jefferson. And he stopped, and he came back with them right about just after I rejoined Paul, too. So he's been with us for a long time. And Jude Gold is the latest lead guitarist.
Do you miss Paul Kantner and your friends? I mean, how many of your friends have you lost along the way?
Tons.
Janice
and Jimmy Murray's gone. John Cipollina's gone. Nicky Hopkins is gone. Jerry Garcia's gone. God. And Marty now.
Mm-hmm.
Paul. I mean, that's the curse of living. That's the curse of getting old, you know. Some people drop off.
If you had to do it again, would you do anything differently?
I don't think so. I mean, knowing what I know now, of course I would. But you don't.
No.
This is how you know it, and you know now. It's by,
but you are,
by
you,
screwing up.
But you are on tour now. You're still a performing musician.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, do you think that you're stronger for your experience when you're out there? Does it, do the audiences change? Does your relationship with the audience change at this point in your life?
Seems to be getting better for me. But I don't know. It could be just the novelty that, hey, this guy's 80 years old. And he's still able to stand up there and scream. So I don't know.
How about the amplification? Something I've been learning about in my interview with musicians is the damage that comes over time to being exposure to loud noise. Is that ever a concern for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm always surprised that you can't hear the ringing in my ears.
That loud, huh?
You always stick it up close to the mic. No. No, but I do have a lot of tinnitus right now. I have since like 1970s probably. And it seems like it came mostly from standing close to the cymbals rather than the loud amps.
Amplification's changed and refined and improved. So amp seems
well,
to
now,
me.
Well, now I'm on stage when we go out there. I mean, we don't. I play through one amp that never turn it up very loud. And our lead guitarist plays through two deluxe reverbs, which are just teeny studio amps. But they're mic'd. And so they can be as loud in the house as you want them to be. But they aren't so loud on stage that they drown out the vocal mics and things.
Mm-hmm. I see. Can you think back into your career?
Plus, I mean, a lot of people wear the in-ear monitors, which can save your hearing if you haven't lost it already. But I mean, because they block out everything that's there, so you can get a very even balance of what you want to hear, so you won't get killed. They actually can protect your ears. I don't know how many people actually do that, but it can be done.
I've heard that Bill Champlin told me that it disrupted the sound. He couldn't quite hear things as easily.
The bass got all.
So he doesn't wear them.
Yeah. I wear one because I'm the only one in the band that wears them. But I like, but so my right ear can actually hear. Actually, I put my guitar in my right ear so that I don't have to turn it up real loud on the stage.
I see. Yes.
So that it's manageable for the sound guys, but I can hear myself as much as I need to, and then my left ear is a speaker on the stage.
If you look back into the expanse of your career and you think, yeah, it's been a while. You've had a lot of performances in your life. You've been with some amazing musicians. You've really had an amazing career. Like, people dream about having the kind of career that you've had. Is there a particular night that sets apart or a moment?
Not one.
Or a few. Or something that happens.
Most of the things that really stand out are things that, like, playing at Monterey Pop. But that was mostly for all the people I got to hear close up. I mean, Otis Redding. Got to hear Otis Redding do this great set and just be standing on the... I was standing on the stage with my elbow on the bass player's amp listening to that one. And I was on the stage like from... I don't know, not 20 feet away from Jimi Hendrix, when he did this big thing and he burned his guitar on the stage and The Who. And
how about Janis Joplin's performance?
Janis Joplin. Well, I heard both her performances, the one that was filmed and the one that wasn't. Yeah. Her performance was great. Actually, probably one of her better performances she ever managed to pull off, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But she was great.
Interesting that it's beautiful that you say that your most memorable moments are your experiencing the performances of other great musicians.
Okay. But there were some really good ones playing, too. I mean, you know.
Yes, of course.
A bunch of them with Quicksilver that were good. They were a lot insane. And a bunch with Jefferson's Starship, too.
When you see, there's going to come a time, certainly, and when you're going to.
Actually, we had a great time in New Zealand.
Just this last, yes, I saw on Facebook, it looked great. There's going to be a time, though, when you segue from this stage to the next, and you'll have friends already there for you, Marty and John and
maybe.
Others. Yes, it's a metaphor.
I don't know. I'll find out.
If that happens, what will you say when you, I mean, how, do you see yourself playing music through all eternity?
I hope so. God, that would be wonderful. But I won't know about it till I get there. I wouldn't know about this till I got here.
Why don't we venture away from realms of possibility and return to realms of the past? Tell me about your time in Homestead Valley.
Well, see, I was working for that foreign freight forwarding company in the city. Because I got busted the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I drive, you know, that was I just commuted from this little room underneath somebody's kitchen, I think it kind of, you know, I don't know what really was illegal, but it
felt that way.
It felt like it could be, but it was nice. And actually, I think it was the place Dino Valenti was staying.
You mean the house, the larger house?
No, the room was where he was staying, and I'm remembering more details now. So I could get that if I watched his dog, named Mondo, who was a Great Dane.
Great big dog.
Great big
so
dog.
So if you would be the dog sitter, you'd get his.
Yeah, I could leave him there all day. It was okay, apparently. Trying to remember the details of that, how I got to work and come back.
You're a commuter. You're a working stiff.
I was commuting to the city, yeah. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, a guy showed up from New York who said he was Dino's bass player, and he's supposed to take this place.
This is your mooch.
Yes. So I said, well, okay. As soon as I find a place, you can have it. So I found the place San Quentin Village.
So, but what was it like in Mill Valley? What was the ambiance of the town for you? What was it that you appreciated about it or didn't appreciate?
It was quiet.
It was a quiet town then?
That was real country. I mean, that was just out in the redwoods, really.
Are you a hiker?
Not really. I'm a walker. I like to walk, but I don't think I did much hiking then. I don't know. Actually, I think all I did was, it was about the same. I'd go to work and then get back and play guitar.
Go to bed, wake up, go to work, come home,
whatever,
play the guitar.
Yeah. And it was the same after, his name was Bobby Collins, I think, this guy that came up. It turned out that he wasn't Dino's bass player. He didn't. I don't think he ever did play bass with Dino, but whatever.
Where were the places you hung out?
It was actually
in town?
Nice. It was actually kind of nicer at San Quentin Village with the view of the bridge and everything.
What was it like in town in Mill Valley at the time? It's kind of nice to remember the old spots. When you weren't working or playing guitar,
Sinapa
did you
Farms,
get up?
You mean?
Sinapa Farms. Talk about Sinapa Farms.
Village Music, of course.
Village Music, yes. Across the street from Sinapa
right.
Farms.
More or less, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. What else was there? I mean, I don't know.
This is what year again? There were four hardware stores, at least in the late 70s, there were, downtown.
It had to be 64 or 5.
Oh,
like
well,
that.
That's...
65, probably.
What was the general demographic of the town, do you recall?
Well, I mean, there was John Cipollina, and his family, and Gino Cipollina, the big real estate tycoon, up on Shady Lane.
Their house is still there,
West
the Cipollina.
West Blythe Canyon, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that, I'm sure it is. I don't know. I haven't talked to Antonia for a while, but is she still there? I don't know. But anyway, and actually, was right down the street from there on Eldridge, where girl and I got our house. We rented a house there.
Oh, really? Which house was it?
After Jessica was born in 67.
What house is that? Do you remember? Was it between, what street was it between Cottage and King or King and Shady?
It was before King Street. After King Street, then you go around and you get to Shady Lane.
Uh-huh.
Right?
So Eldridge in that area.
And there was, it was right at a corner where there was a road that went up, and it was past where Hayakawa used to live.
Uh-huh.
But I don't remember the actual address.
Did you live near?
It was just like a two bedroom, but the second bedroom was down kind of underneath it, and a nice kitchen and a lot of giant bamboo outside.
Well, you had access to Blythedale Ridge right there from your house, because you could walk down West Blythedale to where Ralston meets Blythedale, and there's the fire road there, or the old railroad grade.
Yeah. Had access, but I didn't do it. But that was nice. But then the landlord who lived up the street said she wanted to sell it and offered it to us for some I mean, if you think about it now.
Must hurt just to think about it.
$22,000 or something like that. And
opportunity
I didn't get it because
lost.
I would have had to borrow the down payment. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to borrow a down payment.
No, it sells for $2
million. And there's also, I think there's two houses there now because there was an extra lot.
Oh, ouch.
I mean, if I bought it and I just held on to it, I could have just retired.
And we would have been denied all that wonderful music. How about, did you go to any of the local restaurants or bars?
Not a bar person normally. So I don't think I'm trying to think of a bar. Other than the 2 a.m. club, I don't know.
How about
that was always there, wasn't it?
Since the beginning of the earth.
Yeah.
How about some of the people you remember in Mill Valley?
Charlie Deal?
Everybody remembers Charlie Deal.
Yeah. But old toilet seat Charlie. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Wow. I really don't.
Did you used to visit Marty Ballin when he lived in his house on Blythedale?
Yeah, I went by there a few times. One was when I was writing Jane, because I think he actually, that's his, the Jane part, just Jane, because I was writing and I was just calling it Girl. And I didn't want to do that because that would make everybody think it was Girl. And it kind of was, but, you know, it was about some stuff that we had gone through. But we made it more generic love song. It was about, you know, a girl was running around.
So when you
and so
really...
And I said, he said, I really shouldn't call us Girl, should I? And he said, no. He says, listen, maybe you should change it to Jane Doe to protect the innocent. Or guilty, as its case may be.
So that's how
it got named, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Interesting. So
that was after the song was completely done.
Did you used to hang out?
Jane does sing a little better than girl. I don't know, girl. I don't know.
I think it's perfect the way it's performed now.
Yeah, I think Jane worked.
Yes, it did. Did you used to? I mean, by the, well, you missed the onslaught of musicians that moved in later.
Yeah, because I was out of there by 68.
And that's when others were entering at that
and
time.
I think I moved over to someplace in Tam Valley, back in the hills, back in Tam Valley, but which I don't remember the name of that street.
Marin Avenue, up above?
Yeah, up above.
Who were your friends in Mill Valley at that time? Oh, I mean, people that you would have associated with.
It was all band.
All
the
music.
The Cipollinas, yeah. And Duncan lived there, too, down. Oh, the Dina was there. I remember, though, first part in Marin, the first place was Quicksilver. Quicksilver lived in Mill Valley at the house down... just down the street there.
Cascade?
No. Right. I don't know. Practically right downtown. There's where all the shops end, and then there was a street that went back.
Yeah, Ethel, or not Ethel, but that one little short street.
No, it was just a very short street when then the steps started.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying?
The Dipsy Stairs?
Yeah, the Dipsy Stairs start right at the end of the Dipsy Stairs. There was a house back there behind what was kind of like a restaurant. And I don't remember what the name of it was at that point.
There was a restaurant up there? If you were going up the Dipsy Stairs, all three flights?
Right at the bottom. It was on Throckmorton.
Oh, there right was a restaurant.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the one that burned down eventually?
Did it probably. Anyway, there was an old house back there that Quicksilver lived in and was in. Possible. The police were always there looking for runaways. And, you know, when we were trying to practice there, you know, it was really ridiculous.
Well, so the band's living there, and are there runaways there?
Well, they thought, one of them was Julia.
The girl you married, anyway, so she would.
I think I had married her already, so she really wasn't.
So was that a time when a young person could go hunt for their favorite band and then go live with them if they wanted? So was there something like that going on?
It'd be more than if they wanted. I mean, somebody else would have to want it too. I don't know. It was a little crazy and too public. You couldn't get away with living right there.
Uh-huh.
And so all of a sudden, we said, our manager said, what do you want? And I said, well, we want to live on a farm at the barn we can practice in. And boom, he found a place in Olema. And it was an old dairy farm. And we could practice out in the barn, where the milking room was.
And away from downtown.
Then we found out that wouldn't work either. That was like 66. And by 67, it was because we realized anytime we had a gig, we'd have to pile all the stuff in this Volkswagen bus and drive all the way to the city and then drive all the way back out there again. And all our gigs were like at the Fillmore or Avalon.
And gosh knows.
So we had to move to the city.
Uh-huh. Oh, so then.
For 67, yeah.
For 67, you actually lived in the city.
Yeah, 20th and Diamond for me and Gary Duncan and Greg Elmore. Lived at 20th and Diamond. John had a place. John and Jimmy had a place down at the bottom of the hill till Jimmy moved to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
And then it was the summer of love, and all the people looking for hippies moved in, and we had to get back out again. So then we moved to Eldridge.
Uh huh. I see. And then you had your
Julia and I moved to Eldridge and. Mm-hmm. And then something happened, and she left, and I moved in. She went on one of her trips with Jessica, my daughter, And I moved back to the where was that, Tim?
Over in Tam Valley, that place you were talking about up in the hills.
Yeah, over in Tam Valley. And I think after that, I moved to out in San Geronimo.
Now you live in Novato.
Yeah. Moved there in 1970, that house.
Well, at least you've got that affordable.
The price will kill you there, too. $36.5 yes. for that house. Oh, yeah.
Any other place? Oh, I did want to ask you about your time at the San Quentin Village.
Mm-hmm.
Who were your neighbors there?
I have no idea.
You never?
I never talked to them.
Did it bother
you? I really wasn't there that long. I mean, it was probably 4 months before they came and
set you up.
And then it was anybody's floor that was available for a while.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever mind being a couch surfer?
Yeah, it wasn't the pleasantest thing, but it was it was okay.
Okay, when you're younger, huh?
I don't think I'd want it now. Sometimes there wasn't even a couch. It was a floor surfer.
Do you remember Prune Music in Mill Valley?
Kind of, yeah.
The music store. Any other, before we close the Mill Valley chapter, anybody else that you think of in town that will help us remember that era or something about the town that stood out to you?
I remember just loving back when we first moved over there that you could drive to the top of Mount Tam. And there'd be an open restroom.
That is important.
Well, I mean, you could actually, I mean, we actually spent a lot of time just sitting up at Mount Tam all night,
mm-hmm.
you know, before somebody ruined it. I don't know. So they had to close it.
You mean they closed the gate?
Yeah. It was
back then you didn't
have. It was just
open.
It was just open.
Really? There was no gate that closed at sunset?
Didn't close at sunset. No, why would you close it? What are people going to do? People will take LSD up there. That's what people would do. That's why they stopped it.
Mm-hmm. I see.
I think, because that's what we did. But we didn't cause any trouble.
Interesting. I just interviewed Pat Williams, who was the innkeeper at the West Point Inn, but he was the lookout up there on Mount Tam. He talked a little bit about that, the hippie kids moving in and doing LSD on the mountain. Was he talking about you?
I don't think he would have noticed us. We didn't. We just. Mm-hmm. I remember once that was while we were living in Olema, and we just drove up the back way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really foggy and drizzly down there. And as soon as we got up to the top of the mountain, it's clear and warm. And it was like, I think it was a full moon or something like that. And we watched. It was a special one, and we watched the sun go down back there, and the moon came up, and then we just sat there until it was reversed. And it was gorgeous, you know.
Has nature ever inspired you in your writing or your work?
Probably. I can't quite think of how.
Well, I think...
Cummins kind of like, can you hear it in the morning, sings the golden sun. Life's song is moving ever onward from and to the sound of one. And I know that was Marin County that brought that out, although I wrote it in San Francisco. But
what song is that?
The Fool.
The Fool, yeah. Well, maybe Mount Tam did its magic in silent ways.
I'm sure. It was an interesting night.
Is there anything we haven't talked about in this interview that you'd like to say?
Mm-hmm.
Anything we've missed at all?
Oh, well, there's a bunch of stuff, but I can't think of what it is.
What would you say to somebody, a young musician, trying to come up and
in the world, the world that we live in today. Any pearls of wisdom you can share with young musicians?
I'd say enjoy it. Learn to enjoy practicing. If you can't learn to enjoy playing things over and over again until you get them right, so you can actually have some. It's got to be fun to play. Got to be fun to play and practice. It's like if you want to be a really good guitar player, you have to live with that guitar. And to be a really great guitar player, you're going to have to want to live with the guitar. It's not a job. You have to love it. And all the really great guitarists I know, you know, are always playing. They can't be away from their guitar.
Even if their only audience is the San Rafael Richmond Bridge.
True.
Okay, well.
You know, even if you don't have an amplifier and all you have is your electric guitar, you're still going to be playing.
Duly noted.
I think that's it. Or if you're going to be a singer, you got to be singing.
Okay. I think those are good words to live by.
And you got to love it. There's no point in it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your history with me, for sharing your passion, because obviously you have a great love of music, and that's been a driving force for you. And thanks for sharing the memories of the amazing times you've had here in the Bay Area and beyond with such wonderful people and great musicians and your lovely family as well.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you taking the time to come here into the rubber room of the Mill Valley Public Library.
It's a nice rubber room.
Thank you. We like it. And so I think we can conclude this.
Well, thank you.
And on behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society, I extend my hand in appreciation and shake it with wonderful David Freiberg. And that concludes our interview.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.